Have you ever heard of a third voice? Do you ever wonder ways that you could improve the communication within your child's IEP team? Or if you're a professional sitting at that IEP table wondering, we've got to do better? Today, hang tight. We are talking about navigating special education in a way that is incredibly powerful and the power of building positive parent-educator partnerships. This discussion that I'm having with Peggy and Tamara is dripping with hope and guidance and really is going to hopefully shift a mindset as you listen in terms of creating that positive parent partnership with the school and at the IEP table. Welcome to the Special Ed Strategist Podcast, where we strategize all things special ed. I am excited to have this conversation with you guys, to listen and seriously grab paper, some pens, coffee, whatever you need, sit back and get ready to absorb this information, talking about a third voice in terms of coming together and collaborating, cooperating, compromising to come and find a beautiful consensus to better support the children that we serve. I am your host, Wendy Taylor. I am my mom and special educator. I have sat at both sides of that IEP table as a parent and a professional. And over the last 25 plus years, I have made it my passion and mission to help parents and professionals bridge learning gaps, access special education services, and build kick-butt IEPs. If you want more tips, show us some love on social at Learning Essentials. If you are new to our podcast, give us a download, a follow, a like, or a share. Let's get ready to strategize special education style. I am very excited to connect with both of you today and talk about the power of building positive parent partnerships, especially as parents and professionals are navigating the world of special education. So I am excited and elated to chat and pass on some knowledge to our listeners. So let's kick it off by having you introduce yourself. Peggy, would you like to go first?
Sure. My name is Peggy Budd. I am an educator. I've been in the business for well over 30 years. Began in public education, now a consultant with my practice is Speaking Skillfully, and I'm a co-author of Navigating Special Education along with Tamara.
Hi, I'm Tamara Jacobson, and I've been also in education approximately 30 years. I began as a teacher, as so many do, and quickly moved into administration. I now am the executive director of an educational consulting firm, East Coast Educational Consulting, and I am the co-author of this wonderful book, Navigating Special Education, the Power of Parent-Educator Partnerships.
Can you guys tell me how you connected and how this book came to be? Because this, we're going to drop a lot of nuggets during our conversation, and I want to just kind of give a backstory about how the two of you got together and how this book is going to be out into the world.
Okay. Basically, Tamara and I met on LinkedIn. We live 100 miles apart. If it wasn't for LinkedIn, we would have never met. That's how we came to meet. And after we got to know each other, we really realized we had so much in that, and we had so many great ideas that we decided we really wanted to write a book to share this information with parents and educators. Tamara, why don't you add a little more?
I think when Peggy and I started writing to one another on LinkedIn, it was very obvious that so many people had been through so much in the education system negatively. And because Peggy and I had both been administrators for the school system and then crossed over into our consulting lives, and myself as a parent of a child with special needs, we really had a more positive approach and we were excited to find that commonality. And I do want to say that we wrote this book over a very good meeting point, and it was COVID that actually helped us finish once Zoom became a very common thing.
I love that. What a great story, and especially to have that goal of empowering parents at the IEP table. Can you describe the main goals of building a positive parent-educator partnership?
Well, we can start with the goal of building a partnership is really to get parents and educators to really start to talk and listen and understand each other's perspective. Because if everybody's coming at it where they've got their own mindset, not as much is going to be accomplished for the child.
So it's very important that when parents come to the IEP table, that they know that their role is to be part of the IEP team. However, in our book, we want them to take the team and make it more of a partnership. And in doing so and partnering the educators at the table with the parents, it really does build trust. And it's very important that outcomes come out of that trust and an openness and a willingness to communicate going forward. We also want to say that it's important for parents and educators to come to the table with data. And we talk a lot about data collection in our book and how trust and verification and transparency are very apparent when you have data to back up your philosophy and your quotes. And that's a great way to build partnerships.
A partnership, the idea of a partnership, really to piggyback on what Tamara is saying, which is everything that we so strongly embrace, is that a partnership creates a third voice. And we even, going back to our relationship, we feel that that's what we've done. We each came to the table with obviously a lot of common feelings, but we still had our own ideas and beliefs. And we have truly listened to each other and embraced and understood the other person's perspective, which is so important in this process. And from there, we have created what we see our book to be as a third voice. And that's what we're hoping that parents and educators can do at the table, is really to listen and create a third voice that is what is going to be the best plan for the child.
And on top of that, it's very important to get to that third voice that the parents learn and the educators learn about active listening and respectfully dialoguing, which we're going to talk about.
Can you describe a little bit more what you mean by third voice?
A third voice is really a voice that isn't really, it's not exactly what I think, and it's not exactly what, in our case, Tamara thinks, or in the case of the IEP team. Educators have their opinions, their ideas, what they think as the greatest, best recommendation for how to move forward with the child and plan and program for the child. Parents also have ideas. A third voice is really listening and saying, okay, I hear what you're saying. It's, I would say, almost linked to, in some ways, compromise, but it's more than compromise because I'm not giving in anything. I'm really embracing what you're saying and you're embracing what I'm saying. And we have really come up with something bigger, better, different, and more wonderful than what either of us thought about at the beginning.
I would also love to add that in terms of the third voice, if you could get to where the student is having a voice at that table, because students at a certain age are not at the table. And so I think the ultimate goal is that when the educators and the parents actually form this third voice and also come to a shared vision, it's really the child's voice, the student's voice that's being heard.
So when we talk about the stakeholders at an IEP table, can we talk about who those stakeholders are? And then it leads me to think about, in terms of this process of a third voice, what are some techniques to get to that positive place? Because as a mom of a child, we have three boys. My middle son is a brain cancer survivor. You come to that table with such fear and love, and then you have other stakeholders at the table that have their ideologies and so forth. How do we get to a place to respectfully hold that space for a third voice?
So I would like to say that the third voice is really very important, because what it does is it takes the power away from both the educator and the parents. And what it does is it brings you to an equal playing field. And through the 5C model of communication, which Peggy's going to speak about, and it's in our book, we give you the tools necessary to get to that third voice. And also, the idea is to really bring both parties to have a shared vision. And so when both parties are being heard, and we've gone through the 5C model, as well as bringing data to the table, the defenses come down, the trust is built, and we get to where that third voice comes through. So it's in our book, and we give you those tools through the 5C model.
I love that. And so before we are going to dive into that 5C model, and I love that clarification, can you, for folks that are listening that may have never been at an IEP table or are preparing for their first meeting, can you identify the stakeholders that are at that table?
Sure. Well, it starts out with there are educators, and they're not just this child's regular or, you know, typical teacher, but there's also any special education teachers. There are any sort of related services people, whether they're OT, PT, speech pathologists, social workers, psychologists, all of those people are also sitting around the table, which it can be intimidating to a parent. And then there's usually a school administrator who is acting as a team leader. And then there are the parents, and sometimes the parents may bring a consultant. And of course, when meetings get adversarial, there are oftentimes lawyers sitting around the table. So those meetings can be very overwhelming and intimidating, and they can actually prevent everyone around the table from truly listening, but more often saying, well, this is what I want to say, this is what I want, and just wanting to get their voices heard. And we really believe if you're going to build a partnership, going back to, you have to really listen, hear what the other person is saying. And when we really listen, we do find that there are going to be points of agreement. And then we have to really explain why we're disagreeing, whether it's educator or parent, because everybody has reasons to disagree.
I would also like to add that at the meeting, we call this the landscape of practice. We call it the community of practice. And within that community of practice, there are very important stakeholders. And, you know, my colleague Peggy described some of those individual stakeholders. But I think the most important thing to realize for parents is that every individual school and every individual school board and every individual state has its own community of practice with their own trials and tribulations and things that they believe in, things that have worked, and they bring all of that to the table. So in looking at your stakeholders, I would say it's important for parents to do a little bit of due diligence in terms of knowing the culture and the community of the facility that their kids attend. I think that is very important.
And I'd also like to add that as soon as a child is old enough, and within the law, it's usually 12 or 13, we really believe that their voice needs to be at that table and heard if they can in any way do that. And in our book, we even have a story about a student who ended up being the one that spoke at the meeting and really was able to present themselves. Because if the voice is the students, having been an administrator at many meetings when and a consultant, if I can get the student to say what they feel and what they think, and not only what, but why, and how they will use whatever they're asking for, then it's really powerful. And sometimes I've seen school districts where people would have said they would have never done it.
So let's talk about, you know, I think it's interesting how you describe the landscape and the culture within a school building can differ very much even within a district. So tell me the 5C model of communication.
Sure. The 5Cs are conversations, collaboration, cooperation, compromise, and consensus. And when we begin with those conversations, too often you will attend an IEP meeting and you will find that conversations aren't really happening. What's really happening is a monologue. And I mean a monologue on the part of the parent and the educator. The parent is asked to tell what they think or what their concerns are, and nobody goes deeper than maybe asking another what question. Conversations are what you really want to dig deep, why and how. The same is true when educators give reports. They just read a report or tell how the child, you know, what the child is doing in school, but they really don't explain the how and the why and what they're doing and what's working and what isn't working. And those are the conversations that will help parents and educators develop what we're talking about is the third voice.
And sometimes when dialogue is going on, we find that in the IEP meeting, because of all these feelings and anxiety and unsureness, it's nobody's fault, but we do feel like the conversation breaks into more of the negative, which might go into a diatribe or a debate. And we really strongly feel that it's important for everyone present to try and keep it into the positive and just stay in dialoguing. And so not having a monologue where you're, you know, on a soapbox, but really dialoguing with one another, like Peggy said, getting into the why and the how. And that, you know, as long as it's on your mind to stay positive, that you're dialoguing back and forth and no one is right, no one is wrong, everyone is there for the right reason, then that piece of the conversation, which is number one in our 5C model, really works positively. And then Peggy can explain how, when you go from the conversation, we move to the second step.
Okay. And conversation allow people to start to take perspective, understand perspective taking, and it also allows them to together develop their own shared vision. And what happens in so many IEP meetings is that the district kind of comes with their shared vision of how they think it's best to meet the child's needs and also what they think the child needs. It's through those conversations that parents and educators will start to form that partnership through a shared vision. And once you have that, you can start to collaborate, and you're collaborating on all aspects, developing goals and objectives and thinking about program and services, and it's all collaboration.
And in fact, one of the things that we really feel is best practice that is not being done across the landscape of education today is under collaboration. Once you're trying to form a partnership, if you're an administrator with those parents, we actually suggest that a pre-meeting to the IEP meeting take place. As part of collaborating, getting to know somebody in a very casual setting is very important. So in our book, we actually mentioned the pre-meeting. If the administration can bring in the parents in a very non-threatening, non-IEP, non-formal way, they start to collaborate and have a nice dialogue in a positive way. And so that's one of the things that our book suggests going forward. And then from collaboration, we move to...
We learn to cooperate with each other, and cooperation is just another part of collaboration. And once you are having deep conversations and are open to really collaborating with each other and cooperating, then if there are differences, you understand the other person's perspective and you've unpacked some of these things. And so then parents and educators will hopefully now be ready and available to discuss some kind of compromise if they can't reach consensus.
That's right. And you know what? I just want to interject on this. I think this is phenomenal for professionals and for parents. And again, you're coming from, as a parent lens, this fear, this love, anxiety. When you're at a table, you walk into an IEP meeting, it's like a board meeting. And you're, you know, when you come into that meeting, you're usually the last one to arrive, maybe you know, somebody is coming in after you. So it's usually, you know, the smallest, tiniest chair in a tight little corner or however, and now Zoom makes it a little bit different, or Google Meets or however. But I want to just go back for a second with that conversation piece is ginormous to me, because you're absolutely right in terms of, for me being on either side of that table and sitting at that IEP table as a professional and as a parent, too often those reports are read to you verbatim instead of explained and a deeper dive and making the connection. And really, as an educational diagnostician, for me, the best part of that, of any type of report, is the how and the why. You know, you have the data there, but why? What are the connections? How can we develop something that's really truly individualized for that child? And I would say through that conversation of the how and the why, that very first C of your 5C model, you're developing trust on either side. And so I think the deeper that trust and respect is as a mutual partnership and relationship, that collaboration, cooperation, compromise will start to flow with limited friction. I'm not saying it's going to work 100% every time. I can't imagine that, but I think it's a really good starting point to encourage people to have conversations. And it makes me think of, again, my three boys and just everybody wants to be on their phone. And I'm always like, be human, have a conversation, you know, right? Let's go back to the basics. So let's continue with our C's.
When you have good conversation, it humanizes each of the team members and helps you build that partnership. Because to get to a partnership, you really do have to have trust, and we're going to get to that. But I think the conversations flowing really do help you with that.
And I agree with Tamara. I want to add that through that trust, conversations also need to develop that transparency. I think too often, and I'll tell you, not only sitting at the table as with parents or as a consultant or as a parent, but also as an administrator, oftentimes there isn't transparency. Everybody's sort of afraid to say what they really think or what they really believe the child needs. Or when questions are asked, they oftentimes hedge the answers because they're afraid, well, that's not what we were really presenting. So that's where we want that open and honest relationship, that if a parent asks something, that we're going to start to develop trust and transparency.
And I also think it's important for parents to realize that directors of special services, supervisors of special services also have their regulations and their limits too. And sometimes this causes an ethical dilemma on the part of the supervisor. And both Peggy and I have sat in that role as well. And it's important to just bring out that for the families listening to this today, understand that they also have a job to do, the supervisors. And sometimes it's a budgetary concern, although we know money is not supposed to play a part. Sometimes it's they know that in their district, they're not going to ever get certain services. So there's a whole litany of things that come into that conversation. And it is important for parents to just step back a little bit and be aware that there's an ethical dilemma there as well for the supervisors.
That's an interesting perspective, and I'm glad you shared it. I think it's a very real perspective that I hear all the time from both sides, parents and professionals. How could a parent, because you have both been in that role as administrators, how can a parent or an IEP team really work to ensure the child's needs are met if there is this, as you say, ethical dilemma?
Well, one thing that it really helps drive that through those conversations is really the why. So a parent requests something, they want whatever, and the district feels that they either can't afford or don't have the resources, teacher-wise, whatever, to do it. What we need to do is have those honest conversations so that people can really tell the why. So if a parent wants something, it to just say, I want this, or my child needs this, and not really look at what they need. a lot of different ways that need can be met. And that's really where those conversations go. It's not just, I want this one thing, but, and the district should also have those same conversations of how they could meet that need in maybe a more creative way or a different way than the parent had ever thought about.
And on top of that, when we're talking about budgets or inner city communities that don't have the tax money funneling down to the students and the special education department, it is important to be creative, as my partner Peggy said. I actually have just written some things about this, but when looking at the community organizations and the monies that might be available to do some sort of wraparound services that some states have and some states don't, or to look at the medical insurance, and we are investigating these type of things. And luckily in the year 2022-23, I will say that more administrators, especially in the lower socioeconomic levels in those schools, are looking for alternative means to try and meet what the child needs. But I agree, it's very important not to come in and say, this is what I want. And that's why we spend so much time honing in on data, bring the data.
I was just going to say that. That brings it all back to bring the data. As a parent, bring the data. As a professional, have your raw data sheets. If you don't data, it doesn't happen.
Right. And it's very hard to argue with data. For example, if a parent talks about the child's meltdowns and my child needs these services because of that, that's very subjective. If they come in with a 30-second video clip or a video clip for a couple of days that shows how the child throws themselves on the floor every day when they walk into the house, that's powerful.
So we were talking about actually our fourth C. So Peggy, would you like to pick it up from collaboration?
Compromise is really something that I think sometimes people, educators and parents, kind of dig their heels in and they don't want to do that. They're afraid to compromise. They're afraid that they're going to have to give something up. And what we have found that really a compromise goes back to that third voice, that third idea. If I listen to what you've got to offer and look at what and why you're offering it, and you listen to what I'm asking and the what and the why, then we may come up with a way to compromise that actually either combines a little bit of both or actually comes up with something totally new and different that neither of us would have thought about and may actually be a better program than we actually started with.
Can you give me an example of when you have seen compromise shine?
That's a wonderful example. I mean, questions are to talk about. I have seen compromise in so many of my IEP meetings where both parties have gone through some of these steps of building trust. And I've been a educational consultant on, you know, representing families now for over 10 years. And a great example of compromise is when the parents came in and they truly could not afford a special needs camp, which would afford the child services with sign language and a one-on-one OT and a one-on-one aide. And the district had never actually paid for in extended school year, ESY, a family to attend such a camp. And the cost of something like this is upwards of $8,000 to $10,000. And this was not budgeted for. But after this positive, trusting relationship that had been built, when the parents actually proposed the need for this student to attend this program and how it would impact the fall programming and the positivity and show proof of acceleration of the student's learning and also fill any voids over the summer, I saw a compromise on the part of the school district where they were willing to actually find the funding and send this child to that camp. So hopefully that's a good example. And it was a very successful summer for everybody.
That's an amazing, amazing, unheard of story. Is there one that is probably more common that you would see of a shine with just even with our C's so far, a conversation, collaboration, cooperation, and then as we're discussing compromise in terms of something that you've been like, wow, but maybe not on the way budgeted, under budgeted side. I love that story, by the way. I mean, that's spectacular. Holy
shit. Tamara, it's a great story and one that I think warms everyone's heart. I think that one of the things that when there is trust and there's this openness to compromise, I think what also happens is both districts and parents realize that if you're not willing to give a little and maybe accept a little bit of differences, this meeting, first of all, the child may end up getting nothing because you're going to go to due process and then you're sitting there where everything is, you know, where it started. That's not working. And so actually compromise can really save districts and families money and stress and aggravation. And I think that as you build that trust, you start to realize, okay, where do I give a little? Because if I say no, and then you file due process as a parent, it's going to cost the district thousands of dollars in legal fees, which they hadn't planned to do. But now they'll say, okay, if this is what, we'll bring in a couple of kids or kids from several schools within the district to do that. And that's another creative way, which without that willingness to compromise would not have happened.
So another quick anecdote that is a little bit more realistic in my years of being an educational expert is that I have seen multiple times where families will come in and they want their child placed in inclusive settings. And so this is a very common thing. If the child is on the spectrum and they were maybe in a learning disabled room with, you know, two teachers and eight students, now the parents are asking maybe to be in a little bit more of an inclusive program. And the district is feeling like, well, I don't really think that the student is there yet. The behaviors are still there. And we do have to think about the typically developing neurodevelopmental appropriate behaviors that go on in a gen ed class. And so I have seen many times where they're willing to give the family a experimental 3-month trial period where the students are not going to get hurt who are, you know, sitting in the class and they're learning how to deal with somebody who's, you know, neurodivalent and you have a different thinking. And also if the behaviors are going to really rear its head, it would probably happen within 3 months. And one of the things Peggy and I very long ago agreed on is that when you go into a negotiation, it's really good if you can say, I'm not sure if this is going to work, but let's try a trial period. And both of us feel that a 3-month period is like a very good best practice for this trial. And so that's something that came out of compromise in my experience is that inclusion piece.
And I agree with Tamara that idea of compromise. So now nobody's giving in all the way. What they are doing is saying, okay, we'll just give you a few months, whether it's we'll give the district, and I've seen parents give the district a few months to collect data to show that something works instead of just saying, wait a minute, I want this. Okay, I'm open to listening and seeing if it works.
I love that example because it really does shine that kind of compromise that nobody's giving up, nobody's giving in, but you're really saying, you know, if one partner in the team is passionate about for or against something, it's saying, let's give this a try. You're meeting in the middle. Let's collect the data. And oftentimes the kid is successful and it's amazing. And then now you know, and you can build that support as needed around that. I think that's excellent, an excellent example. Can you then tell us about consensus? What does that mean?
Well, consensus really means that everyone on the team agrees with what is being proposed. And that's where at the end of every IEP meeting, when, you know, it said, okay, this is what we're recommending going through program services and placement. And everybody says, yes, I agree. And we don't want it to be, yes, I agree, where somebody's acquiescing and just giving in. And we really want parents to feel when they say, yes, I agree, that they truly agree. And then they're partners. If they just agree because they feel they don't, one, they don't have a choice, or they look to the educators as, well, they're the experts and they know, and I guess I have to agree. That's not really consensus.
I also want to add that it takes time. These things are not going to happen overnight. Parents are not in the same position to have the pre-knowledge of an educator. And that's the way the system is set up. You know, teachers go to school for a long time to become a professional and an expert and have the knowledge they do. And parents have had those children since birth, and they know their kids better than anybody. And so to get to where there's actual and true consensus, I want to just bring up to our audience, this takes time. This is not, okay, we're doing everything now. And so we're all in agreement, you know, hoorah, and it's great. No, each step of the way helps to go to where there is that general consensus that everybody has that third voice and that wonderful shared vision that is going to go into the IEP and translate into success. And so I just wanted to bring up the point that to get to consensus, I want everyone to be realistic. That takes time and it takes effort on every stakeholder in the meeting and doing their part.
And I'd like to add to that, that not only does it take time, it requires everyone to come to that meeting with that openness and willingness that they realize that building a partnership rather than the parents and educators just being on this team is a possibility. And that is and it's the system in many ways is somewhat broken without a partnership. And so in order to fix it, it's not a legislative fix. It's a mindset shift that fixes it.
How can we, or how can parents address an imbalance in effort from the IEP team? So we've outlined the process and everything is amazing, but sometimes there may be that imbalance in the effort of an individual on the IEP team. Do you have any advice for parents that are listening or even professionals to encourage the balance?
It's such an important question. I mean, how can parents feel a little bit more empowered that they're part of this team and moving toward partnership? And I think just in sheer numbers, the underrepresentation from the parent side, you know, puts them in a position of feeling that way. And then the fact is that in education, in our community of practice, we have a vernacular. We have a specific vocabulary that teachers and administrators and special ed supervisors, they all speak. And the parents may not even understand, let alone if they're a second language speaker, and then they need, let's say, a translator, which they're entitled to at the meeting. And so you have all of these barriers to make what appears to have the parents feel lesser than. And so your point is very, you know, important. How can we make parents feel empowered to be sort of not at a disadvantage? And the number one thing that we really always want to get out is parents can bring as many people as they would like to these meetings. And so many parents are not aware that they can actually bring people to speak on their behalf or to just be there for support and to actually, you know, discuss, maybe witness to some of the behaviors that they've seen. But as long as you let the case manager or the administrator know, you can bring multiple people to that meeting, which we encourage as educational consultants. And that sort of helps that imbalance to begin with. And then a second thing that can be done, again, is to really do those pre-meetings, letters to the teacher, teacher conferences before you get to that IEP meeting, so that when the parents walk into that meeting, they're not feeling like everyone was whispering about us, you know, for 10 minutes. And now here we come in and everyone's, shh, there's some hidden agenda.
So uncomfortable.
Right. But instead, they've met with them several times. There's humanness, you know, the human nature. They've broken those barriers down. And now there's that comfort level and support where they feel like, oh, I really am a partner at this table. And so those are just two concepts I wanted to bring up, Peggy.
Yeah, I want to add to that something that we talk about in the book is an idea of helping parents understand the alphabet soup of the meeting by what in the pre-meetings talking about things, giving them basically a cheat sheet of the terminology that may be used at the meeting and what it means. And then when asking it, basically defining it anyway so that the parents feel that they understand and it's not just a bunch of words or acronyms, that they really understand what is being said.
And parents receive by law the due process guide in every chapter or a manual to sort of read through and get them ready. But we do understand that if you're not coming from an educational background and you're opening that manual that's mandatory, well, we sent you, you know, your brochure, until you break that down for you, you don't really still understand your rights. And so some of our suggestions that are in the book talk about, you know, where to get this help of understanding the world of education. You would, as a parent, you would spend time maybe looking at safety for cars for your turning 16 or 17 year old that's driving. And, you know, we don't say, hey, you're putting all this time and effort into the research to buy a car. So we don't feel that bad saying we've been educators and we're asking you to do a little bit of research and learn a little bit about the due process, because that's going to help a lot.
Right. But one of the other things, I totally agree with you, but one of the other things I think we talk about in the book is that due process, when you get that procedural safeguard document along with your invitation to a meeting, is very intimidating because it's legalese. And now all of a sudden you feel like, what's going on? Why are they doing this? And therefore, we really need to make sure that they understand that it's not, we don't want to intimidate them, but that does intimidate them. So that's why those pre-meeting conversations, that's why the cheat sheet, that's why all of that, those conversations are going to help parents feel a part of the team and not feel that they're alienated in the meeting.
You've brought up the term pre-meeting a couple of times today. So can you give me an example of what a pre-meeting would look like for a parent, or is that only for professionals? What does a pre-meeting mean?
All right. What we conceived of is when, you know, possibly parents have, and we hope parents have met with teachers before you get to the IEP process, and they may have even met with administrators. But when we're going to have this, instead of just sending them this invitation, to call them up and say, would you like to come in for a cup of coffee and just have a little chat and say, we are not at a point where we need to go into this formal process, explain to them that the process is actually developed under federal and state law, to just let them know that this is everybody, but it's that all of this is really to provide your child with safeguards, and then to explain to them a little bit so that they feel comfortable. That meeting over a cup of coffee, because if you drink coffee, you know, sort of breaking bread, it makes it a comfortable situation. That meeting can make them, when they now come to that IEP meeting, they already feel like they have a friend. Oh, I met with so-and-so, and they feel that connection.
So one of our concepts for the pre-meeting was, you know, there's a library in every school, or media room now they call it, and there's a cafeteria or a general, you know, location. So a principal or a director of special services may not want to bring them into their office and just have a cup of coffee, but instead meet in the general location, a very non-threatening, you know, your child didn't do anything wrong. And if the parent can't take off, another way, if they can't come in during the day to do this, might be to say, hey, I'm going to send you a Zoom meeting. We have a meeting coming up. Let's just have like a group meetup. Do you have any time after work? We can meet for a 15 15-minute block, I'll have my tea or coffee or a glass of wine waiting, and we will keep it casual. And anything that you'd like to ask me as an administrator, I'd love to answer. It's the timing of it as well. But if the family is able to come during the day, we could have them come into the library or to the cafeteria and just meet with them and say, I'm here for you. I don't want you to be nervous. Do you have any questions for me? And so that's kind of our concept of what it looks like.
I am smiling. I know people can't see as they're listening, but I'm smiling because when I was in the classroom as a special education case manager, I never called them pre-meetings. I didn't have the foresight to do that, but I would call parents ahead of time and just, that is establishing trust. It is building a relationship, asking, do you have any questions before this meeting? And I've already spoken to them several times about their kiddo and the successes that are taking place, not necessarily calling to say, hey, you know, this happened and this is wrong, but really it's an incredible way to develop that relationship and humanize this very stressful, overwhelming experience for parents. And so I love that it's called a pre-meeting. And again, now with Zoom or some sort of virtual meeting place, it makes it accessible for families to be able to start to build that rapport and that understanding with each other and setting that success for that 5C model.
Definitely. And the concept of pre-meeting, I mean, it's just any meeting is a pre-meeting. We just kind of called it that way. And we're not saying that there aren't teachers and educators and administrators across the country that may not be doing this. What we are saying, this isn't, you know, standard practice. This isn't what happens for every meeting with every person. And we're saying we think it should be standard practice.
Right. It's not a requirement. It's not a federal requirement.
Nope. So, and it's not a district requirement.
No.
It's correct. And so you were obviously a caring, outstanding educator who realized the importance of building trust and helping parents come to the meeting comfortable. A lot of people don't do it. And I will tell you that when I've shared some of our ideas with other professionals and colleagues, they'll say, oh, well, how can you even recommend that? We don't have time. We're already overworked. We feel that if you put the time in up front and build that trust, that those meetings that were set for an hour and ended up to be 2.5 hours, maybe the first time it will be 2.5 hours, but that trust and those pre-meetings, now the meetings will run smoothly, quickly, and the student will get what they need to be successful. And the parents and educators will feel like partners, and that's the best way to go.
It sounds like you are a wonderful case manager, and we need thousands of you who do take that extra step to help the parents feel comfortable in the process. And part of the reason we wrote this book is not really just to help the parents, but really to represent the side as well of the education system and to just try and bridge some of those partnerships and give them tools to do that. All we can do is the best we can do.
That's right. And so timely, because educators are frustrated and overwhelmed right now, to give them this permission to kind of make these connections if possible. And you're absolutely right. By building this partnership in advance and doing the heavy lifting ahead of time, you're setting the stage for hopefully a smoother conversation, discussion at a formal IEP meeting.
And I will say, getting back to data, the reason that we spent so much time on the importance of data, and we actually give in our book, we give some examples of what data collection should be based on the different diagnoses, what parents should collect, what administrators and educators should come with to the table. We wanted to give examples or exemplars of this, and we felt that one of the best ways to take away this anxiety that we've talked about throughout this meeting is really to be armed with just facts. And the more facts that you have and the more data that's been collected and reviewed, the less arguing is going to occur, because it's very difficult to argue with facts. In fact, if you look at debate, right, you go ahead and you collect all of your data, and then somebody stands up and they read through really quickly all all of their facts. And so these are the facts of the children of the special needs child who's going to need special services. And once this data is collected and the tests have been given, and the parents have also come with their actual concrete, you know, video collection or, you know, papers or showed the homework and how it's ripped or whatever it might be, which we give many examples of in the book, it's really arming the conversation. And it helps to really move that conversation along in a very positive way.
And to add to that, not only does it do that, it helps reduce that emotion. Remember at the beginning, Wendy, you talked about parents come and they feel all this emotion and anxiety. And as educators, we've both been educators and administrators. We too do these meetings with anxiety and apprehension because we, all of us, want what's best for the child, whether we are agreeing or disagreeing. I can't believe that there are any meetings where the people, where either side or either group or either stakeholder is presenting something that isn't in the best interest of the child. So this, that data removes that emotion and helps it, you know, be more user-friendly and helps people really feel like partners.
Parents, and you had alluded to this, Tamara, about some examples. Can you just share a couple more? Because oftentimes parents feel powerless in the sense that they are not in the classroom to say, okay, my child answered this correctly. They were paying attention this much. They transitioned this way, to really collect, as an educator would collect data. What are some examples that parents can do in their home when their kiddo comes home? What would that look like so that they feel empowered with some low-hanging fruit at the end of our conversation today to say, okay, now I know what I could do?
Right. So, you know, Peggy sits on the board of some private institutions. I am a public, I do a lot of speaking engagements for higher education. And, you know, we've both given the sort of the 3-month or 6-week data, you know, best practice to our administrators or our, the people that are at our meetings. And so an example of some of that, what in our book, what we've done is we've given models where we put the behavior, the time of the day, the location that it's occurring, whether at home or community or school. We've really broken it down to, we even give examples of what behaviors are not typical and that you should look for under specific diagnoses. And so what our book does is it gives actual samples where you can actually just, you know, print out a lot of the samples that you can then put into like a loose leaf or what we call a portfolio of data to bring and to hold on to. But an example of this would be, let's say you have a child who is on the spectrum and the child cannot sit to do the amount of homework that the teachers have given them. And so they're ripping the paper and they're kicking their feet and they are, you know, just misbehaving. And then eventually the parent is trying to come over, sit with them, and eventually they're knocking their head against the wall, literally, and having physical, you know, outbursts about the homework. So an example of how to record that data would be, like my colleague Peggy said, visuals. And video is so powerful. And when you bring some of that video, it's indisputable. And then on top of that, we also have them chart, this is the time that it happened. This, the antecedent of the homework caused this behavior. And we have these charts and graphs where you would record it. And then you would keep that over the series of several weeks. And you know that your meeting is coming up. You can also ask for meetings much more often than just your annual IEP meeting, which we'll talk about. And my colleague Peggy wants to piggyback on what I'm saying, but that would be one positive, you know, thing that we sample in our book.
Totally agree, Tamara. And I would just add the video, some easy things. Have your child sit down and read a page from a book. and just bring that page. I mean, it can be literally a 30-second video, takes no time at all. The other thing is indicate, I know homework oftentimes, as Tamara is talking about, becomes a real difficult time for, and parents are frustrated for a variety of reasons. They can either just write on the top of the homework, you know, the time the child started, and then 15 minutes, draw a line, this is all they did, or an hour. And then one more thing, the idea of when the child is struggling, parents should let the school know what they did to help the child. And I think too often they're saying, well, my child struggles. Okay, well, here is the paper. And if I sat, maybe if I sat next to my child, they completed the project problem. If I didn't, they didn't. Or if I, and show what you did. That gives the school district the teachers, some indications of what kinds of support. The same should be true of the educators. What is the strategy you're using to help the child learn? And that's, again, where that partnership, that homeschool partnership, where parents and educators start speaking the same language to the child. It's not just speaking the same language to each other.
It's also very important to write down if you have ADHD or the child is medicated. It is important to write down the time that the students took their medication and then look at, were they able to sit? And if they have ADHD, how many breaks, let's say, did the parents notice that they had to give the child during a series of, let's say, a 15-minute assignment? And how many times were they redirected? And then compare that to if the student takes their medication in the morning before school, how many times did the teacher have to redirect the student? How many times, you know, if they took their medication at 8:30 in the morning, but they've redirected until 10 o'clock in a block, how many times did the student need to get a break and go walk the hall or ask to go to the nurse, even though they don't need the nurse? So, you know, we have our diagnosis and what is typical of handling those recordings, but include the medication piece because that does give more of the profile to everybody at the table as to what's helpful in terms of solutions to the behaviors.
Phenomenal. Phenomenal. I mean, I feel like I could sit here and listen to both of you all day. I mean, this has been incredible insight. It's been so gracious of you to offer your time and insight. I have one final question for both of you. And that is, if you had a piece of advice that could go on a billboard, what would it be and why for parents?
You can go first. I have to think.
My billboard would be positive communication drives partnerships. And by having you think about relationships as partnership building, you become really part of that team. So think about positive partnerships through exciting and passionate conversations, which will lead to trust and being an excellent team member.
Perfect.
One of the things that we do in our book is we have some quotes, and one of my favorite one is the single biggest problem with communication is the illusion that it has taken place. And I think that that billboard should talk about, don't think that you got your message across, make sure that you did clearly explain the what, the why, and the how of your feelings, parents and educators.
Amazing. This whole discussion has been dripping with golden nuggets for sure. How can folks find you? How can they find your book? How can they reach out to you? Tamara, let's start with you.
So Peggy and I have we actually have a little introduction video. It's a very cute cartoon, and it sort of explains some of these golden nuggets that are in Navigating Special Education. You can find that at navigatingspecialeducation.com. And that is a joint shared website that is for our book. And it has that cute little video that I highly recommend everyone check out. It has our bios. And then individually, both Peggy Peggy and I have our own companies. You can literally Google my name, Tamara L. Jacobson, and get to East Coast Educational Consulting. And I'm available for professional development, for speaking engagements. Peggy and I are available together for that. And we just really want to help change the landscape in 2023 and bring best practices forward.
Thank you. Not only can on the website do you see the video and learn all that, but you can pre-order our book, or you can pre-order our book by just going out to Amazon and typing in Navigating Special Education. We're very excited about the book and really feel that although it's now for pre-order, it will be available by the beginning of March. So that's really exciting. To reach me, my website is PeggyBud.com. You can also find me at SpeakingSkillfully.com. And my email is Peggy@PeggyBud.com. PeggyBud. Okay, thank you.
Thank you, everybody. I appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having us, Wendy. This has been an exciting conversation. And as you know, conversations build partnerships.
Thank you so much, Wendy. We really enjoyed being a part of your podcast. This was a wonderful experience.
Thank you. Thank you again for listening to this important conversation about how to collaborate, cooperate, compromise, join a consensus, and work to better support the children in and out of our classroom, in our home, whatever that may be for you. My three special ed strategy takeaways from this podcast include: be mindful of that third voice, coming together as a team, as an accountability partnership, as a positive partnership. Whether you're a parent or a professional, we can all have conversations, keeping that student first and foremost in every thought that we have regarding their education and their educational impact. Keeping in mind that dialogue that is open and dialogue that is positive lends to the best results. That pre-meeting to really kind of set expectations, to demystify any questions and ensure that the parent feels that yes, indeed, they are an equal member. And then as a parent, boy, some really good nuggets there at the end in terms of how to really collect evidence-based data to bring to the school, to show the school where your child is once they come into your home as it relates to education. Thank you again for strategizing with us and spending your precious time listening. If you've loved what you've heard, give us a like and a follow at Learning Essentials. Looking for free tips? Head over to learningessentialsedu.com and you can download free tips to prepare for an IEP meeting, plus bonus questions to ask. I am your host, Wendy Taylor. If you need more special education support, visit Learning Essentials, where we provide an individualized and systematic approach to supporting students with various learning needs and differences through academic coaching, educational therapy, and BrainCamp, our executive function support model. If you are a parent, I've got you covered. Head on over to learningessentialsedu.com and I can walk you through that IEP journey.